Hello and welcome everybody to the World Scouting Museum's Daisy Doll and Steve Scout podcast. My name is Alex Bennett and I'm the museum curator for the World Scouting Museum. And our hosts today are going to be Daisy Doll and Steve Scout, as always. We hope that you really enjoy this episode. This week we're going to talk a little bit about Garfield, the spokescat of the Boy Scouts of America, or now Scouting America, and the history behind how Garfield became a spokesperson or spokescat for the Boy Scouts and their Cub Scout recruiting efforts specifically. So without further ado, let's have Daisy and Steve get right into the topic today. We hope that you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We take piles of research, all sorts of sources, and try to pull out the really key stuff you need to know.
And today we're tackling a genuine pop culture icon. I mean, the orange tabby cat. Everyone knows him.
Right. Known everywhere for, well, loving lasagna, hating Mondays,
Yeah.
being maybe a bit lazy.
Yeah.
Garfield, of course.
Exactly. And while, he's the world's most syndicated comic strip character, which is huge in itself,
Massive.
his life outside the panels is maybe even more interesting. We're digging into this specific time when Garfield, this, let's be honest, pretty cynical cat, became an official uniformed spokescat.
For a major American institution, no less, the Boy Scouts of America. So yeah, this is our deep dive into the BSA's first nationally coordinated Cub Scout recruitment drive. They called it the Garfield Roundup back in 1999, running into 2000.
It's a fascinating story, really. It shows what happens when you mix like high-level corporate branding and licensing.
With the super detailed on-the-ground reality of a massive volunteer organization.
Exactly. So our plan is to explore the marketing strategy, how they actually did that, and the logistics, integrating a mascot like Garfield across thousands of volunteer groups. That's complex.
Incredibly complex. And
Yeah.
we also want to look at the wider context of Garfield's commercial power. Some of it planned, some really not planned at all.
Right. And before we jump in, we really should give a big thank you.
Oh, absolutely. Huge thanks to the World Scouting Museum for sponsoring this deep dive. Their support is fantastic. It lets us explore these unique bits of scouting history.
Okay, so where do we start? Garfield himself, maybe?
Yeah, let's start there. Because to get why this BSA campaign was such a big deal, you first have to understand just how enormous Garfield was commercially. He wasn't just a comic strip, he was built to be merchandised.
Absolutely. Jim Davis, the creator from Muncie, Indiana, he was actually pretty open about it back in 78 when he started. He saw a gap, Lots of dog comics, but no big cat character.
Huh. Interesting.
And he literally said his goal was to come up with a good, marketable character. He focused the humor on really universal stuff, eating, sleeping.
Things everyone gets.
Yeah.
And totally apolitical.
Totally. And wow, did it work? By 2013, Guinness World Records confirmed it most syndicated comic strip in the world. Something like 2,580 newspapers.
Just staggering numbers.
And it wasn't just papers, because the themes are so simple. Lasagna, Mondays, naps, they translate anywhere. So the merchandise just exploded. You're talking hundreds of millions, maybe even $1 billion a year. Toys, games, credit cards.
Food items, yeah.
Yeah.
He was everywhere. A global brand built on, well, being lazy and sarcastic.
Which brings us to the big question, right? Scouting is all about duty, effort, being active, service, basically the opposite of Garfield.
The total opposite. So, how did the Boy Scouts and the National Council decide to team up with this particular icon?
Well, it wasn't just a cold business calculation from the BSA side, not at first. The push actually came from Jim Davis himself because of a personal experience.
Oh, really? What happened?
Yeah, about 5 or 6 years before the national campaign kicked off, he went to an Eagle Scout Court of Honor. It was for his son's friend near his home in Indiana.
An Eagle Scout ceremony.
Yeah. And it apparently hit him really hard. He said he was just so impressed by the dedication, hard work, and tenacity it took to get that award.
So wasn't it just, oh, that's nice? It really resonated.
Deeply. It shifted his whole view on youth development. He actually said that if all kids went through scouting,
Yeah.
the world would be a truly wonderful place. That's a pretty strong statement.
Wow, okay. That's a serious endorsement.
Serious enough that his company, Paws Inc., didn't just license Garfield to the BSA. They gifted the license, gave them the rights, the artwork, everything. They called it a full commitment. It was more than just business.
That changes the dynamic completely. It's less about, selling Garfield merchandise and more like Davis wanted to use his creation's huge reach for something positive.
Right. But even with Davis on board like that, the BSA National Council, they needed data. They couldn't just roll this out nationwide based on a feeling. They needed to know if Garfield could actually, you know, get kids to sign up.
Makes sense. So a pilot program.
Exactly. They tested it for 2 years, starting in 97. They used the Crossroads of America Council in Indianapolis, which was Jim Davis's home turf. A smaller scale test to see if it worked.
And did it. Did the cats deliver?
Oh, yeah. The results were, well, they were frankly amazing. The sources even called it a campaign with legs, whiskers, and a fat belly.
Love it. What were the numbers? Okay, get this. A 13.9% overall increase in Cub Scouts in that council.
Mm-hmm.
But the really crucial number, which one?
Was the Tiger Cubs, the first graders. They saw a 16.2% jump.
16.2%. Wow. Why is that group, the youngest ones, so important?
Because that's the entry point. If you get a kid and their family hooked in first grade with Tiger Cubs, they're much more likely to stick around, move up through Cub Scouts, maybe even into Boy Scouts later.
Ah, so it's about the long game, securing the future pipeline.
Exactly. That 16.2% wasn't just kids signing up for 1 year. It was potentially locking in future members, future leaders, maybe even future Eagle Scouts. That pilot success basically greenlit the whole national thing. It showed Garfield worked.
Okay, so the pilot proves it works. But you still have that disconnect. Lazy cat, active organization. How did they sell it? What was the slogan? They leaned into the fun side.
Mm-hmm.
The official national slogan was, Cub Scouting, because too much fun is never enough. Catchy. Ties into Garfield's appetite for enjoyment.
Right. And Jim Davis himself gave a quote trying to bridge the gap. He said, Scouts are as American as lasagna. Garfield and Scouting make a perfect team.
Okay, perfect. I see what he did there. It frames it as fun American. It sets the stage.
It sets the stage for what turned out to be a massive logistical operation.
Right. Moving from a pilot to a full national rollout, that's where the complexity really ramps up.
Yeah. This Garfield Roundup was, like we said, the BSA's first nationally coordinated Cub Scout recruitment drive. That means National HQ wasn't just suggesting things. They were sending out very specific mandatory instructions to every single local council. Hundreds of them.
And these councils are mostly run by volunteers, right? So you're telling volunteers across the country, okay, here's exactly how you're going to run your sign-up night, and it involves this cartoon cat.
Precisely. The whole thing ran through the year 2000. They sent out this big two-part package called Tools for Success. It had the council plan, the marketing kit, everything. The Chief Scout Executive called it a very special effort. It wasn't optional.
So the marketing kit, what was in it? How did they push Garfield out there?
It was a full-on media blitz. Radio spots, TV ads, they even did PSAs in both English and Spanish, which was smart for wider reach. Print ads, too. Aimed at kids, but also definitely at parents.
Got to convince the parents about the values while the kids just see the fun cat.
Exactly. But the absolute core of it, the thing they said had to work, was the in-school strategy.
Going right into the classrooms.
Yep. The plan was super specific. Volunteers had to go into classrooms for a really short visit, like 3 or 4 minutes max, just a quick pep talk.
Keep it brief. Respect the teacher's time. Smart.
Yeah. And right after the pep talk, they personally handed out flyers inviting kids and parents to the big Join Scouting Night.
So quick pitch, then a physical reminder to take home.
And they even had audio support. They sent out cassette tapes. Remember those?
Oh.
Barely.
With a pre-recorded Garfield principal announcement. The idea was the principal would play it over the school intercom, adds that official school endorsement, plus the fun Garfield voice.
Wow, they thought of everything. And visual reminders, too.
Oh, yeah. Every local pack that's the neighborhood-level unit got a 3-foot-tall cardboard stand-up of Garfield for the sign-up events, plus yard signs popping up in neighborhoods everywhere.
Like political campaigns, but with Garfield.
Kind of. And speaking of Garfield himself, the actual costume appearances were really tightly controlled.
How so? So just pause. Ink was watching closely. Very closely. There were only 4 official Garfield costumes available for the entire country. Councils had to reserve them way in advance. And pause. Ink had to approve the schedule to make sure.
Wait, let me guess. Only 1 Garfield per media market.
You got it. They didn't want multiple Garfields confusing people or diluting the brand. He even did big public events like the Minnesota State Fair that August.
Okay, and I see some examples here of local councils really running with it, like the Viking Council in Minnesota.
Yeah, they did some cool stuff. They partnered with Domino's Pizza Flyers, went out on pizza boxes right before Join Scouting Night.
Targeting families right at dinner time. Clever.
And Famous Dave's, the BBQ place, offered a free kids' meal for every new scout who signed up. They even set up a special phone number, a Garfield hotline, 1-877-9-SCOUTS, just for getting meeting info.
So Garfield was truly everywhere. School, TV, yard signs, pizza boxes.
Pretty much inescapable if you were a parent with a young kid that fall.
Okay, so all this effort gets families to the school gym for Join Scouting Night, set for September 16th, 1999. But getting them there is just step one. The night itself had to be perfect. The plans called it a proven plan, no deviations allowed. Why so strict?
Because that night was the conversion point. It's where interested families actually sign the forms, pay the fees, and crucially, where parents step up to volunteer if that night felt chaotic or disorganized.
You lose them instantly. Especially the parents you need to run the dens.
Exactly. So they needed military precision, and that relied on having specific volunteer roles filled before the night even began.
Let's break down those key roles. Who were they?
Okay, first, the Join Scouting Night coordinator, basically the event manager. They dealt with the school, made sure the room was set up, ran the agenda like clockwork, and this was critical, had to report the results immediately back to the council. Fast data turnaround.
Got it. Second,
the Tiger Cub coordinator. Remember, that first grade group was vital. This person focused just on them and their parents, handed out the special Tiger Cub booklets, the activity packs,
and got the first meeting set up.
Yes. Their job was to identify the host family for the first two or three den meetings right there. So the den could start meeting literally the next week. No delays.
Crucial for keeping momentum. And the third key role.
The registration coordinator. This was the person handling the money and the paperwork. A really sensitive job.
Dealing with fees, applications.
Yeah, they had to know the exact fees, have the right forms. Mm-hmm. And the instructions specifically say they needed to make arrangements to have change available.
Huh, the details. Imagine trying to make change for dozens of families in a noisy gym.
Exactly. They collected all the checks and cash, gave it to the PAC treasurer, who wrote one big check to the council. Super streamlined. They even had backup plans if they ran out of forms, use index cards.
Incredible attention to detail. What about the actual flow of the evening? How did they keep the kids from, as the sources say, uncontrolled running, shouting, and horseplay?
Good question. They had older Boy Scouts run games and activities before the main program started. Kept the new kids busy while parents finished registering.
Smart. Crowd control. Then the key move, splitting the groups.
Oh.
Right. Different info for different ages.
Yep. New Cub Scout families grades 2 to 5 went to one orientation. Tiger Cub families grade 1 went to another. Each got their own specific parent orientation booklet.
And these sessions covered everything. Benefits, structure, costs.
Everything. How dens and packs work, advancement ranks, typical activities, and yeah, the costs were laid out very clearly.
Let's talk about those costs for a second. Because the way they collected fees was pretty strategic.
Yeah.
It was. The national fee was $7 per kid, $7 per adult leader per year, plus $9 for Boys Life magazine.
But here's the kicker. PACs were told to collect not just the prorated fee for the rest of that year, but...
but also the entire fee for the following year, all up front on the first night.
Whoa, why push for basically a year and a half of fees right away?
Purely practical. It was all about simplifying the annual rechartering process. That's the big administrative headache where every unit has to renew its membership and pay fees for the next year.
So collecting an extra up front made that process smoother down the road. Much smoother. It locked in the funding for the new pack, made rechartering easier the next fall, and maybe reduced drop-offs because families wouldn't face another big fee request relatively soon. Though they did stress financial aid was available. Cost wasn't supposed to be a barrier.
Okay, that makes sense. But the real make-or-break moment of the night, the ultimate goal, was getting adult leaders right.
Absolutely. That was the end game. After the info sessions, they'd break everyone into small groups, potential dens of 6 to 8 boys by grade, right there, in circles.
And then put the pressure on?
Pretty much. They'd appoint a temporary chairperson for each circle. That person's job was to get commitments then and there for a den leader, an assistant den leader, committee members.
So no, take this form home and think about it. It was a direct ask, face-to-face. Exactly.
Yeah.
Ideally, they'd already identify some potential leaders beforehand, but if not, they used the direct approach. Reminded parents that scouting helps them spend quality time with their son. And then the big question, can your son and the rest of the boys in this den count on your support as their leader? Wow. That's powerful. It really brings it down to a personal level. That 13.9% increase wasn't just a number. It was thousands of moments like that. A parent saying yes in a school gym.
Exactly. Making sure the unit was viable before people walked out the door was key. And once that commitment was made, Garfield was there to seal the deal, so to speak.
Ah, the merchandise, the reward.
Right. The BSA supply division went all out with Garfield Cub Scout branded stuff.
What kind of gear are we talking about? Beyond just patches.
Oh, way beyond. There were practical things like jumbo pencils, but also collector's items. Garfield hat pins, pewter tankards, embroidered jackets, even a big Garfield Afghan throw blanket.
An Afghan, okay.
Mm.
But the plush toys must have been big sellers.
Definitely. They had Garfield in his Cub Scout uniform, a 12-inch one, a slightly smaller 10.5-inch standing one, and even a little 5-inch one with suction cups.
Like the ones people used to stick on car windows.
Exactly. That kind of retro touch. It just shows how thoroughly this campaign saturated everything, from the national strategy down to the little trinkets. It totally changed the feel of the fall sign-up.
It's really something.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the inherent weirdness of it all, maybe.
Hmm.
The contradictions.
Yeah, it's fascinating when you step back. You have this character famous for, you know, avoiding effort at all costs.
Right. Gluttony, naps.
And he's the face of an organization built on hard work, responsibility, getting outdoors. How did the BSA square that circle? They couldn't exactly make ads saying, be like Garfield, eat lasagna.
So what was the angle?
They were clever. They shifted focus to Garfield's other public image, his role in promoting literacy.
Oh, right. He did have that connection.
Yeah, for years he'd been a mascot for Literacy Volunteers of America. He'd helped with the American Library Association's summer reading stuff, and even worked with Barbara Bush on her radio story hour. He was seen as a top cat for reading.
So the BSA pitch became less about Garfield's personality and more about reading makes you smart, and smart kids are scouts.
Okay.
Basically, yes.
When?
Boys Life magazine hammered this home. They used Garfield with the slogan, "Good reading makes you smart." It associated him with intelligence and engagement, conveniently sidestepping the whole lazy cat thing. Smart branding by both Paws, Inc., and the BSA. It worked incredibly well for the campaign. It shows what careful brand management can do. But that same global reach that made Garfield the perfect BSA mascot also led to situations where his image took on meanings they absolutely did not control.
Right, and that leads us to the bizarre, long-running story of Garfield as an accidental environmental mascot in France.
Okay, this sounds wild. What happened?
So, starting way back in the mid-1980s, these plastic novelty Garfield phones.
The ones where he's lying down and you lift the receiver and his eyes open.
Those exact ones. They started washing up on beaches in Brittany in northwestern France. Not just one or two. Consistently. For years. Decades, even. Long after anyone actually wanted a Garfield phone.
Just showing up on the beach? That's weird. Super weird. Bright orange plastic. Often broken, sometimes weirdly intact. It became this local mystery. Environmental groups, beach cleaners, they were all trying to figure out, where are all these plastic Garfields coming from? And did they figure it out?
Yeah, just recently, around 2018, 2019, a local farmer finally connected the dots. He remembered back in the 80s, after a huge storm, finding a lost shipping container wedged deep inside a sea cave.
A shipping container? Full of Garfield phones.
Well, mostly empty by the time he found it, but it had the packaging.
Yeah.
It seems this container full of phones fell off a ship, got stuck in the cave, and for 30 plus years, the ocean currents slowly pulled the phones out and dumped them onto the nearby beaches.
Wow. So the same mass production and global shipping that put Garfield in every American kid's classroom
also put thousands of plastic Garfields into the Atlantic Ocean, turning him into this symbol of plastic pollution washing up on French shores.
That's an incredible irony. In the U.S., he's the managed face of youth values. In France, he's the accidental face of environmental waste.
Exactly. He became this very visible, tangible symbol of, as one source put it, overconsumption and unconscious consumerism. The cat, famous for consuming lasagna, became a symbol of how we consume the planet.
It really highlights what Jim Davis said, doesn't it? He just wanted a marketable character.
Oh.
He avoided politics in the strip.
Yeah, he joked he thought OPEC was a brand of denture adhesive.
Right. He kept the light. But the character, once it got that big, took on a life of its own. It became part of these much bigger conversations, intended or not.
And people even started playing with that meaning themselves, like that online project, Garfield minus Garfield.
Oh, yeah. That was huge for a while.
Yeah.
Explain that for people who haven't seen it.
Basically, someone took Garfield comic strips and digitally erased Garfield himself, along with his thought bubbles. So you're just left with his owner, John Arbuckle.
And what's the effect?
It's unsettling. Suddenly, John isn't talking to a sarcastic cat. He's talking to himself. the whole thing shifts from light humor to this really bleak portrait of loneliness and maybe even delusion. It's kind of dark.
And Jim Davis actually commented on that, didn't he?
He did. He called it inspired and admitted some of the edited strips worked better than his originals.
Which is amazing. It shows that once a character becomes that ubiquitous, through planned campaigns like the BSA one or accidents like the phones,
it stops belonging just to the creator or the corporation. It becomes public property in a way, a cultural symbol that people can use to talk about anything from youth development to consumerism to existential dread.
Our field contained multitudes, apparently, far more than just lasagna and naps.
Far more.
So wrapping this up, what we've really seen today is this incredibly detailed story of the Garfield Roundup, how the Boy Scouts took this massive pop culture icon, a cynical cat no less, and turned him into their official spokescat through this huge coordinated effort. Amazing logistics, smart marketing.
Yeah, the level of detail is mind-blowing. Controlling the costumes, the mandatory reporting, that super scripted joint scouting night designed to lock in leaders and fees. It shows just how seriously they took making this corporate partnership work on the ground with volunteers.
But the really big takeaway, I think, is that duality, that global commercial power Garfield had.
Yeah.
It allowed the BSA to use him in this very controlled way to boost membership in America. But that same power, that same ubiquity, meant his plastic face ended up symbolizing ocean pollution in France for decades. Totally unplanned.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? About how these purely commercial creations become cultural symbols. Garfield was designed not to have deep meaning, just to be marketable.
Right. Avoided commentary completely.
Yeah.
Yet he ends up representing both something like structured American values and a global environmental problem. So the question maybe is, what does it actually take for something made just for profit to become a powerful symbol for? Well, for things that really matter to us.
That's a great question to ponder. Something to think about next time you encounter that orange cat, maybe on an old comic strip or who knows, maybe washing ashore somewhere.
Hopefully not.
Hopefully not. Anyway, thank you again to the World Scouting Museum for supporting this deep dive into the time Garfield wore a Cub Scout uniform.
Yeah, thanks to them. And join us next time for another deep dive into history's hidden corners.
Thanks, Daisy and Steve, for all that great information about Garfield and his time as spokescat of the BSA. We hope that you enjoyed this episode, and there is a bonus video episode of this available on Spotify, or you can watch it on YouTube at World Scouting Museum on YouTube. Please check out our social media websites and also our website for more information about Garfield as a spokescat on the exhibit spotlight page. We hope that you enjoyed this podcast episode and that you tune in for the next month's episode and that you find more information and things at the World Scouting Museum that you enjoy. So we hope that you have a great month, and we look forward to talking to you again next month.